make sure that you're on our list to find out. We do a lot of things, so just so you know. It's my distinct pleasure to welcome Christian Henkel to the Boise Center as a visiting scholar. Christian is programming director and researcher at the Chivigan Institute for Ecumenical and Interreligious Research at the University of Tübingen. And for those of you who don't know, the University of Tübingen is a very big deal. It's kind of the Harvard of Germany. It's a big faculty, an important faculty, and it's both a Protestant and a Catholic faculty. Christian's PhD from the University of Münster studied how faith-based groups lobbied for undocumented migrants, both in the United States and in Germany. He's currently working on his habilitation. Some people won't have any idea what that is, so explain when I'm done, just explain what a habilitation is. Exploring if and how utopian ideas from the past have impacted our lives through digital devices that monitor our bodies and change the way we make friends and find partners. He described himself, this is a direct quote from his CV, described himself as a political theologian with a passionate interest in all things digital. Okay. Christian, welcome.
Thanks so much. Thanks so much, Mark, for having me. Thanks, everyone, for showing up for this rather informal presentation. So, Habilitationsschrift, let's get that out of the way. Complicated. We love compounds in German. You have to live with that if you live there. So Habilitationsschrift is just a second book project we do in order to, do even more than we did in a PhD. And so as Mark said, I would describe myself as a political theologian. And the job of a political theologian, at least from my perspective, is first of all to observe. So how the church speaks about important issues in the public realm, right? So what I did in my PhD was I looked at how the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops lobbies Congress for the rights of undocumented migrants. So, this is what I came up with then. So, I just went there and asked, how do you do that? And I sort of figure out that it is an amalgam of personal stories, expertise, allusions to sort of central themes of Christianity, welcoming the stranger, you all heard about that. And so my mission after doing that PhD was, so I can now really help churches to become better in politics, you know? I can really sort of help these people get their message across, become both more professional and more outspokenly prophetic. Well. This is not enough. At least not today. At least not in a time when, not just around the issue of migration, but around so many issues, we have this all-encompassing narrative of fear, of anxiety, coupled with national identity. Amplified by the social media. Politics is about narratives. And so I thought, what is my job then? Well, maybe it is presenting a new narrative, a positive vision for society, a utopian vision of society. This is, by the way, Thomas Morris, Utopia. And Thomas Morris portrayed the best possible form of government and set the scene on a distant island where things work much better than in the struggles of his time. But since Thomas Morris, and at least since the beginning of the 20th century and the rise of Stalinism, or the rise of Nazi Germany, utopia has gotten a bad name. It's been portrayed either as irrelevant, who cares about utopian visions, who care about our daily lives, or dangerous, because utopias could soon turn in the hands of dictators into dystopias. The dystopian visions of the future, you've probably all seen films, you've probably all read books that portray these. But I think utopian thinking is neither irrelevant nor is it necessarily dangerous, but what it is, I'm pretty sure, is it is still present in our daily lives. Enter the iPhone. Let us observe how this device actually links back to the great utopian ideas of yesterday. This is Apple Health. You've probably seen this. Interestingly enough, it's not just your heart rate that gets monitored and the steps you take. It also monitors your mindfulness. Your 2 minutes of mindfulness. It's not my phone. That'd be zero. But what it does is body politics. What the life reform movement, and now we're linking back to utopia at the beginning of the 20th century, was dreaming of something like this. A healthy lifestyle, but also a complete control over the body of citizens. Next utopian example. This is, I chose Apple, by the way, because everyone on campus seems to use Apple. So I could have used the Google phone as well. This is Apple Home, the home kit. We restructure our environments, the places where we live, by turning our homes into smart homes and by turning the cities we live in into smart cities. And again, this is a great utopian idea. Architecture has long sought to transform cities by general planning. Think about the nationalistic architecture of Brasilia. Think about the Bauhaus architecture. And today, the internet giants of this day and age, they are building enclosed campuses where living and working go together, where new visions of utopian city planning actually become concrete in the sense of building material realities. Finally, lastly, Instagram. So the internet, as you all know, stems from the ARPANET, a military service to ensure uninterrupted communication during a time of maybe a nuclear attack. But the pioneers of Silicon Valley soon turned that idea into this idea of universal communication. And the New Age movement and the idea of universal exchange, universal communication, greatly influenced these pioneers of the digital age. So my point is, on so many levels, on the level of our bodies, on the level of the places where we live, on the level of the connections we make, yesterday's grand utopias have somehow morphed into small-scale utopias, utopias on the small screen. So what do I do with that as a political theologian? Well, the most famous triangle of them all, see, judge, act. We've seen what happens, right? But now we should talk about what we make of that and how we can use that. What do we make of that? As I said, utopias are criticized. They have been criticized from the very beginning of utopian thought. As, for instance, irrelevant, Ernst Jünger, a German author, writes Heliopolis, a book where he criticizes utopia as completely irrelevant. At the end, one of his protagonists says, utopia, leave me alone with that. I look at my family, the way I treat my wife, the way I raise my children. This is utopia enough for me. Or, utopias have been criticized as dystopian visions of the future, especially when it comes to technology. And one of the first writers at the beginning, actually, of the Stalinist age was Yevgeny Ivanovich Semyonov, who wrote We, English translation for it, a dystopian version of what it means if our lives are completely controlled by technology. So that's something positive, not the nice iPhone, but technology controlling us, making, transforming our lives into, well, not very free existences. But what about the practical value? What about the political implications of what I've just said about these digital devices transforming our lives? Now, I could, in the good German fashion, now talk about Ernst Bloch. Talk at length about that, bring in other philosophers, writers, I could bring in literature, literary critics, but I chose not to. I chose to start with thinkers that have influenced me in the way I think about politics or political thought as a theologian. And first one I want to start with is, for Germans at least, the most radical, Saul Alinsky. He's not a theologian, but his method has influenced a lot of faith-based organizations, a lot of faith-based groups. And I don't want to go into detail what he has written or what the implications of what he has written are, but my main point here is Saul Alinsky talks a lot about conflict. He talks about a lot about getting your hands dirty, getting into the nitty-gritty of politics. So what do we make of that when we look at our digital utopias? Well, my point here is to say most digital utopias shun away from conflict. It's more escapism instead of social change. But the way we treat our bodies, the way we look at the places we live, the way we make connections, these things are highly conflictual. They bear a lot of potential for conflict. Ruth Cohen is my second voice I want to bring into the discussion. It's my move from radical to deliberative. Ruth Cohen was a psychologist who inspired a whole school of theology called communicative theology, and I'm not the expert on the table for that. That would be, of course, Marian Hinstead. But theme-centered interaction, to put it shortly, a way of group interaction, builds on Ruth Cohen's experience as a teacher and as a psychologist. And she, at the heart of this concept, is the idea that the discussions we have as groups are shaped by the individual's needs, the needs of the group, the matter at hand, and are surrounded by the globe, that is, the conditions of this world. So for me, then, deliberation has to respect the needs of all participants as well as the surrounding globe. And to link back to this idea of digital utopias, most digital utopias don't balance between the individual needs and the group's needs and the matters at hand. On the contrary, we experience, when we look at Twitter networks, for instance, I analyze these, ego networks centered around a central actor who's the only sender and a lot of passive recipients of his messages. Finally, I want to look at something that even critical political thinkers like Saul Alinsky sometimes overlook, and that is the role of tragedy and suffering. And for that, I've chosen Cornel West, because he's aware of the struggles of contemporary democracies. As more and more citizens find themselves in downward spirals and neighborhoods deteriorate. But Cornel West is also aware of the deep resources of the American democratic tradition. He quotes the Greek Socratic tradition of questioning, the Jewish tradition of prophetic critique, and lastly, the tragicomic commitment to hope, as he calls it, expressed for him most profoundly in the struggle of African-American communities in the U.S. And again, I think most digital utopias, most digital tools we use have no room for tragedy and suffering. However, our bodies age, we die, places can change, we can't go home again. and communication links can break. So, what have we learned? Well, if we look at digital tools and utopian thinking, conflict matters, participants' needs matter, and tragedy matters. But also, in our day and age, in these digital utopias, change is already present. We can see how digital utopias take these great ideas from the past and can link to that heritage, but we can also link to our own democratic heritage if we think about digital utopias. Utopias can be a powerful framework for the way we think, but as good theologians, we must be aware that they are never complete. It's the idea of already and not yet. A fully realized utopia could quickly turn into a dystopia. Right. Finally, what implications does that have for acting for what political theologians do today? Well, how do we foster political thinking? How do we foster utopian thinking? For me, the idea of micro-interventions is really a key concept. And that is, we have practices in our everyday lives that are shaped by the way we use digital technology. So why not use digital technology to reshape these practices? And I already alluded to that on three levels, on the level of the body, on the level of the place or the space, and on the level of the connections. So, micro-interventions in that sense could mean bodily interventions, the way we eat and drink together, and how digital devices and the fact that we snap a picture before we start a meal influence the way we treat our bodies, the way we treat community, the way we treat food, and what does that mean for food insecurity, which is an important factor. That could be interventions on that level. Spatial interventions, about the places where we live. And here you can see the churches. Churches have private property in the heart of many cities. If they open these spaces, if they let spatial justice reign in these spaces against the privatization of spaces, that could be an important factor, aided by digital tools. And finally, connectivity. Connectivity interventions on that level. When I started off with the whole digital idea, I looked at deliberative software, online forums that would allow for citizens to discuss political matters. This is an important factor. It's not just Instagram and snapping a few pictures and getting a few likes. These digital networks can be powerful tools to affect political change. Think of Occupy Wall Street. So I'll end with something really practical and with a terrible handwriting, which is mine. Thankfully, it's a German. So I started this project with a few colleagues, and our aim was to have a more inclusive debate about Europe, the future of the European city, and the role of religions and cultures within that. And our idea was to use digital technology to create links between mosques and churches and the urban community. We are planning right now to have interactive screens in public places that would allow interaction, that would show the contribution of faith communities to the whole community, but that would also allow citizens to connect across cities, across walls, across states, to talk about what the future of their city means for them. So it's a hybrid of both living together face-to-face encounters in a real city and digital tools that bring us closer together. So, what is my contribution then at the end of this whole project? Well, I hope that one day I'll get this inscription above my office that just says School of Utopian Thought. Maybe theology and Here's a thought to ponder at the end of this. Maybe theology isn't so much about what Jesus Christ did, how faith communities live, what the ethics are in the public realm. Maybe theology is also a school of utopian thought, and I hope we can foster that. Thank you so much.
You're willing to receive questions?
I was hoping for that, yeah.
Let me start. I'm a Niebuhrian through and through. Underneath all my surface Niebuhrian loyalties lies a vast pool of Niebuhrian loyalties. I think of utopia in the same way that I think of populism. It always leads to some form of fascism. Mm-hmm. And I'm deeply distrustful of utopian thought in Christianity because it always leads to either ignoring of this world, you know, sort of an emphasis on the next world, pie in the sky, bye-bye, yeah. Or an effort always failed, in a, you know, and I'm an American religious historian, so American religious history is just chock full of utopian experiments, you know, starting with the Shakers up to the present. Okay. What would you say to someone like myself who says, utopian thought always leads to some form of really bad thing?
If you take utopia as a blueprint, I would say yes. If someone comes up to you and says, well, I got this idea for the ideal state and I've got it planned down to the living quarters of the workers and the sizes of their beds, and we had these ideas, and the American Christian tradition is full of these sort of very concrete sort of blueprints, you should proceed with caution, as well as if someone says, I can create that. I, just follow me. And so for me, I think this is something where we should distinguish between blueprint utopias and utopian thinking in general, which is aimed at the future, has a vision for the future, but is not as concrete as to say, well, this is how the future would look like exactly, and which is also deeply rooted in the realities of this life, and these realities include the idea that we are social animals, that we are not thinking about this as individuals, but as communities. And so I would say, if we talk about digital utopias then, maybe what we are seeing right now is this blueprint idea. You know, I've got an app, I've got a service, and you've got to use it that way. No room for creativity, no room for exchange. The only thing we are interested in is revenue for the people who sell us these phones and these apps and these services. But if we say, well, why can't we design something that is more open, that allows for creative processes and interaction, and does not, and here's another important thought, does not replace human interaction completely by just saying, well, we'll have it all in the digital realm, but rather creates a hybrid of living here and living digitally, then I would say there is some merit in utopian thinking. And I know that dystopian literature is out there. I know the dangers of this. But as I said, already and not yet. That's the distinction I think you can make.
Thank you.
Was that too long? Sorry.
Is he convinced or not?
Dr. Hensdale, do you have a question?
No, I don't right now. I'm just thinking. I was just looking. I was thinking about your resources that you lifted up. One was Saul Alinsky, and I forgot the. Could you just review them? Because I wasn't.
Saul Alinsky, yeah. Ruth Cohn.
Ruth Cohn.
And the third was Cornel West.
Cornel West, yeah. But you also started out with narrative.
Yeah.
And I guess I tend to be more suspicious of the Saul Alinsky kind of method of community organizing.
Absolutely.
Even though I also know that the Ruth Cohn theme-centered interaction tries to not ignore conflict, which is kind of the plus of Alinsky, but almost it's like he creates conflict. Because he thinks in creating conflict, this is how you can get people's attention and how you can get them involved, because, you know, which can lead also to a lot of problems. So I was just wondering if you had, there were two people maybe we had this little conversation. I picked him up at the airport, so we were talking about a million things that night. But I'm more persuaded, having utilized participatory action research as a form of community organizing, that the approach of like the Highlander Center in Newmarket, Tennessee, where Miles Horton and are you familiar with him?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That really starts building community or getting organized by a kind of popular education method.
Yeah.
So that people realize it's kind of like the Freirean, you know, Paulo Freirean work with peasants and literacy and stuff about that they have knowledge that is important knowledge, but it's not necessarily valued.
Exactly.
You know, because they know how what time it is to put the beans in the ground, but they may not be able to read, you know, a first grade storybook.
Absolutely.
So I just wondered why you didn't bring any of that in. And then the other person I thought of besides Miles Horton was Jane Jacobs.
Mm.
Are you familiar with her? I don't know that much about her, but she's written a lot about urban cities and stuff.
She sort of saved Greenwich Village.
From
being
in the past. Yeah, I mean,
she's
phenomenal.
The great loss. Great loss.
I don't know. Anyway, and I'm no expert on her, but I do know that she's kind of a pivotal figure in terms of this project of public. It's not theology necessarily. But you could look at it in a utopian theological way as sort of, you know, bringing about the reign of God or creating the conditions for that, if you want to take a religious sort of angle on this.
First of all, thank you so much for these suggestions. That could be a valid addition to that. How does the second book work, actually? You're asked to figure out what's your position as a theologian. So in the PhD, you show expertise in this specific field, right? And now the question is, who am I? This is why I start with, who am I as a political theologian? Mm-hmm. And what are my resources? And what I presented to you here is, so what are my resources? How did I become politically engaged? What was my starting point? And my starting point was Saul Alinsky, and I can see how putting people on the spot or having this sort of concrete sort of tactical approach has its merits, had its merits in the past, and has its problems. But I really wanted to take this idea of conflict and see if conflict has... Maybe we shun away from conflict too soon. Maybe that has a positive role. So that was my idea. And the same with Ruth Cohen. So my idea was with her to bring in, so we have now the conflict, but what about the needs that often fuel our conflicts? Because these are conflicts between needs, individuals and groups' needs and surroundings. And I mean, you've experienced our community of theology meetings and the needs of the participants there. So my idea was, so how can I bring in a thinker that has a more holistic idea of deliberation? Mm-hmm. And so I want to take it from there, from the question of how do we as people interact? How do we think about the places where we live, the bodies we have, the connections we make? And so this is why this is an eclectic choice. So this is my disclaimer. You're completely right in pointing out these weaknesses, that there are
say they're weaknesses. Was just the connection with the narrative.
Absolutely.
So in a way, as you're telling your story of how you're becoming a political theologian or how you're doing political theology, and those are the influences. This is my interpretation and what I'm getting
absolutely,
from what you're saying. So I was fascinated. I mean, I'm fascinated... But as a feminist theologian, I think stories are really important in communication, and not moving too quickly to some kind of method or theory or something like that. Not to say that that's not important, because there is always a theory operating, even if it's not acknowledged.
I was wondering, actually, if we were all cognizant of our of these stories that are out there, or if we live in a time where these stories are streamlined into something because of the use of digital technology, the way it influences the way we tell stories, mm-hmm. maybe even like the idea of the narrative has gone a bit amiss in this. So I think this is an interesting concept. Sorry.
I'm first of all appreciative of being alerted to the relationship between the digital world and utopia. That is, I think there's like a hidden messages in there, right? That this is really kind of utopian view, even though I might not be participating in the way that's being introduced to me. So that was very helpful. My question for you, I think, has to do with maybe the relationship between idealism and realism, mm-hmm. that there's a way in which utopias can be over on the idealism end of that polarity, and that it helps us to define the good, but maybe the danger is to define the best. And I'm wondering then if what you're really talking about is a way to talk about the good without talking about the best. Does that make sense to you? Understand where I'm going?
That's a great thought, yeah. You put that extremely well. Do you want to co-write a chapter? Same goes for you, actually. I might still consider that. But
because the conversations about the good, right, are very helpful.
Yeah. But as soon as we move into the best realm, but at the same time, don't we... So this is just, you know, impromptu thinking now. Isn't it important for us to hold values so dear that we think they're our best?
Mm. I don't know.
That is interesting, yeah.
Right? That's the thing. I don't know. Because that's where like teeters over into fascism. When you start preaching that it's the best, then you run into trouble. But we also need to be mindful of what we hold as good.
Or teeters over into inaction. Think, well, don't worry, we'll get reward event. You'll get the best reward of all when you go to heaven. So don't worry about it now. So it's
right.
Scary.
Yeah, because it's hard to kind of sit in the middle of the whole thing, and then say, okay, where's my compass?
Yeah.
Right. How do I know which direction I'm going to go?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Seek the good of the city, not the best.
I think so.
So this might. Yeah. At the same time, so the whole setting of the utopos, of the place that does not exist because it's either on a distant island or in a distant future, is that you have sort of a holistic vision that encompasses not just one aspect, but these were utopian literature was, and I think still is, like about a system where things are, which looks at so many aspects of human flourishing and of human life. And so I was wondering if we're not talking, we're not talking about sort of best practices, mm-hmm. but rather about a more systematic approach to the whole thing, right? It's not just you know, recycle, live well, do one good thing, for instance, interestingly enough, Protestant homilies at the beginning of the 20th century, you had preachers there saying eat more potatoes. Why? Because that's what was needed, because malnutrition was a fact. But this is not the kingdom of God. This is not this holistic idea of living the good life and its many facets. So I'm still struggling how to incorporate that, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The ideas about the good, into this utopian mindset.
I'm curious curious in the act part of the proposal, how you deal with the tension between like the exclusivity of technology that like great swaths of humanity do not have access to or have access to different levels of technology versus like the deep and profound impact that technology has had on the part of humanity that does have access to it.
Yeah. So the whole digital divide question, which also I think there's another divide actually between those that use these services and those that understand them. So when I looked at Twitter, you enter the dark side. That is you. you no longer look at the surface of the app. You look through the API, through programming interface, at the data people generate. And this costs money, to be honest. So if you want to use data, you have to pay money. And so there is divide between those who have the means, either through capabilities or through monetary capabilities, to access this other side of the digital, of these devices, to manipulate these devices. So two digital divides. Both I haven't resolved or haven't talked about. You're completely right. I think that there is a case to be made for, I would say, maybe it's a wrong term, but digital justice, that access to these services is not something that is, these are not luxury items. This is not something where we say we have this model of development, right? And this model sort of resembles a race through our history. We say, you know, you start off with cheap generators and whatnot, and then you end up with iPhones, but the way we work with developing communities and in developing countries has to be influenced by the impact this technology makes. I don't have a solution. I can assure you it's going to be a costly solution, but I think you're absolutely right. This needs to be addressed because otherwise you're not reaching about a significant amount of the population, even in this country. Even in this country, it's about having access to services, and in other countries, it's even, the divide, I'd say, is even greater. But I think also this idea of, so I at the end I presented this idea of urban screens, of urban technology, how people interact with installations. I think providing this access does not just mean everyone having a digital device, but it also for me means that we have this hybrid of personal interaction, community interaction. This does not replace community organizing in its most basic form, people getting together and talking about the things that matter for them. As long as there's a link to other communities, this, so for me, this is more a hybrid form. So this doesn't answer your question, and I can see you're skeptical.
Yeah, I feel some resistance to communities with technology saying that this is the way we have to live now. Or saying that to participate in this conversation, it's going to be a costly thing. There are environmental effects to producing more technology and getting it out to people. And so to say that on one hand, you do need technology to participate in these conversations and create these utopias together with all the perspectives. And on the other hand, saying that your way of life needs to fundamentally change so as to incorporate Twitter and Instagram and Apple Health seems... I kind of resist that.
Absolutely, and I hope it doesn't. And I hope we don't end up with selling these services. I hope we are selling the idea that we can have a conversation about maybe the best, maybe the good life that respects the needs of the participants, that does not shun away from conflict, that has room for tragedy and suffering, first of all. And then, how do we link conversations? There's a question, maybe there's a different form of linkage that doesn't use a mobile phone. Mm-hmm. So I'm not glued to the phone as an idea. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm not even glued to something battery powered as an idea. Maybe digital is a lot more than just an infrastructure. But I still have to explore that idea.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Oh, okay. Thanks so much for a very thought-provoking presentation and conversation. It's provoked several thoughts in me. I'll try to rattle off three of them. One in the form of a recommendation. The conversation about the good versus the best or the dangers of utopian thinking makes me think of Roberto Mangabeira Unger's work, which I think could be a resource there, because you used the language of blueprint as something to be avoided. And he agrees. He draws a distinction between blueprints and programmatic thinking or direction to convey the idea that, yes, we want to avoid having some kind of specific plan for where we need to end up and forcing reality violently to conform to that. But we also need something, we need a relatively comprehensive vision of the good, both of the good life and of the good society to be working toward. And the trick is to calibrate our praxis in such a way that that vision evolves in continuity with praxis. So every move we make towards it gives us a learning that then inflects the ideal mm-hmm. itself. But you need a praxis and you need a context for that praxis in order for that to work. And I think one of his criticisms of our contemporary political situation is we have no such praxis and no such fora. And so I think that's one, a helpful way of maybe thinking through that tension. But two, it raises some of the problems. And that transitions into the second thought. I am an Olinsky organizer, and so I have some pushback on the criticism offered. I think Olinsky is often read too squarely through Rules for Radicals, in which he's at his most conflictual, and insufficiently in the context of Reveille, his first book, but also his own praxis and the praxis of the later Olinsky tradition. And I think for him and for his tradition, in which I work, the core is really relationship. It's not conflict. But conflict is recognized as a necessary dimension of relationship. And because it's a dimension which is atrophied in so many of our relationships, it's one he wants to develop further. But I think, you know, working in the IAF, we're pretty Luddite about technology. And so we're concerned that in an age of the technological quick fix, particularly in our politics and our activism, mm-hmm. what we most need isn't a new technological solution. It's relearning the very basic skills, the narrative skills, the relational skills, the organizational skills in the context of an institution that so many of us have forgotten or never learned in the first place. Mm-hmm. And rather than, I appreciate the move towards hybridism. I get that you're not advocating technology as a solution. But from my vantage point, the two poles of that hybrid are not at all equal. The technology is only as good as the praxis and the community in which it's embedded. And I think the problem is we don't have a good embedded context for it right now. So is the problem creating the technology, or is the problem creating the context first for the technology? And where should the lion's share of our effort be going? That's thought two. Thought three, I really appreciated the move that you made to highlight the way in which our digital life is actually an embedded utopia or a dystopia, right? And I couldn't help thinking throughout your presentation that the utopia we live in is the neoliberal utopia, because mm-hmm. neoliberalism is very much a utopian school of thought mm-hmm. and one that I think has had a lot of influence, not least in Silicon Valley. So is part of what you're trying to do to set up a counter-utopia to the neoliberal one that we that actually has hegemony over our lives? That would be my question to you.
Mm. Wow.
Please see volume two of Christian.
That's a good question.
I would say I probably wouldn't just talk about neoliberalism. Although I can see even through education, how we educate our leaders, how we educate those in CEO positions, that has a tremendous influence. I can see that, but I can also see that we have a lot of digital entrepreneurs who I get the problem with entrepreneurship, and this is a slippery slope. I grant you that, but how people try to create something different, try to create an alternative vision, have something that's not just about a market economy. I could, for instance, talk about the Fab Lab movement, people using 3D printers, but not solely that, but also knowledge and sharing that knowledge. And some of these people then went on and made money with the way they think. And this sort of has been influenced then again by neoliberalism. But I think there, as I tried to show, there are a lot more ideas behind how people design these services.
Thank you, Christian. I think I would like to hear more about this handwritten sketch slide. I think because, like, the only example I can think of, and it might come to campus while you're still here next week, this portal. I don't know if you know of this global project, but if you see a spray-painted gold shipping container by our library next week,
yeah,
it's because it's linking participants here,
yeah,
with like a refugee camp in Erbil, or my class is connecting with Mexico City. Or, so that was maybe one on your hand-drawn sketch,
yeah,
positive. I thought, okay, does he want to facilitate encounter? Still, that's episodic and problematic in some ways. But I think Laurel's point, second point, not the digital divide point, but the maybe malformation of digital users. Well, my point is, that reminded me of, is my question. That's why I would be helped to hear more of the constructive ideas you have in mind. Because I have market economy worries, and even just Siri, turn the thermostat in the bedroom to 72, you know, like there's
you have Black Mirror worries.
Yeah, well, and narcissistic kind of selves, like it's easier for me to identify the potential malforming effects of technology, but I want to be open to what you're suggesting, and I don't think you're suggesting that, but I don't have enough counter examples. I think that's why I want to hear more about how you envision, because I think it would not just be facilitating this from scratch, but it would have to counteract the habituation that most of us who have these devices, in a short period of time, a lot has changed in some negative way, in ways that detract from the good.
Yeah, but there is a whole science around this and research being done on urban computing. What does it mean to have, as I said, this hybrid idea of a place, a space, and in it technology. And there's many ways people use that, but one interesting part was, I walk home from the Boise Center every evening, and figured out there's not many people on the streets. What you see is buildings, and what you see is walls, basically. A few windows, but mostly curtains drawn, you can't get inside. The same often holds true for faith communities and urban spaces. If it's not a sort of a cultural thing where you just visit a church to see the artwork, but where you actually... And we're talking about Yom Kippur. And again, blinds drawn, walls. How do we overcome that divide? Not in the sense that we want to sneak into every room, but how do we do that? And one idea was to use digital tools to help us, to help faith communities actually show people what is going on inside, to invite them to even establish a link, which is more than just showing something, but also inviting participation. Because most of these narratives of anxiety and fear are fueled by the unknown. And this was one idea. So we are still working on this. How can we do this? The other is we use digital maps to guide us through our cities. We rely on these, but they are highly commercialized. They show certain shops, they show certain things, but what they don't show is people networks, is social services, what faith communities actually provide. So people would often say, well, what does the church do for us? And I don't try to market now services offered by your local church, but they're there, they're present, showing this the presence of people and the things that people do, the things how people interact with the community, making that visible. Data visualization. I mean, go into this library in the what's the big library called here?
O'Neill.
They've got a screen. They do visuals there. Social science students, I think, do that, and the political science students do visualizations. Making something appear again. This is an important thing. This has nothing to do in the first place with technology, but people that can appear now. I did research on undocumented migrants. These are people who kind of appear by design of the system here. How do we make these visible? These people visible? One idea. So this is rather abstract, but yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you, first of all. We chatted about this in our conversation before, but it seems like there are a lot of good things that could happen if people kind of reoriented their focus towards using technology in an ethical way or a outward-facing way. But I'm struck by the thought that and I hesitate to kind of place an incentive-based economy over doing good, but it seems like the reason why people aren't is because the incentives are too strong to be self-focused. And both because the tech companies make their phones addictive, we are addicted to screens in a lot of ways. I'm wondering, is there a model that's not purely exchange-based for incentivizing people to use technology in a more ethical way, a less narcissistic way?
It's hard because it's deeply in the DNA of how we conduct our lives in this day and age. So we would probably have to go into alternative economical thinking, sharing economies and all of that. This is happening and people do that. But I think that it probably, as I said in our conversation, and some of you highlighted to this, it's a question how we design. You said that how we design these apps and services, and I think there is a design question that needs to be overcome. It's an important part, I think.
I didn't get a chance to hear the whole presentation, but sure. This is general. So your glasses is like glasses are a technology, and I'm sure you're not even conscious that you have on glasses or a jacket or, you know, like, so we've evolved as a species to the point where certain technologies are just a part of us, and we do them. Like, what's your vision for how you're using the words like digital technology is like DNA, but like I'm like, where is the vision for like how that actually, where it's not even conscious anymore, like we're just putting on a jacket,
And this and digital technology, I think is slowly but steadily transforming into something we are less and less conscious of.
Mm-hmm.
Think of the advent of the iPhone, this idea that you could just tap on something, a capacitive touchscreen,
mm-hmm.
instead of using a stylus like you did in the old devices, sort of lowered that
the distance.
Mm-hmm. And I think it gets even more closely incorporated into our lives, up to a point where you're right, we don't even think about it. So if you have, for instance, if you have devices that respond to voice commands in a natural way, I think about children who have gotten used to saying to their parents, Mommy tells story, because Alexa does it that way. And so you're completely right. This sort of gets so incorporated into our daily lives. I can't predict the future, but I can see where this is going. So the next...
Your utopia had that.
Yeah. Okay. I can see that the next iPhone is probably not a device anymore. Mm. And so technology maybe is not about certain devices, but digital technology for me is a way of thinking about these things. So it's not a tool like these glasses, but it's a way of seeing the world through these glasses. Mm. And I think that needs to be incorporated into the way I approach utopian thought.
I'm wondering about church, and because churches in a way offered a kind of utopia, right? They were a sacred space. It was different from secular life. It was a way to be reminded of another vision. I'm thinking about Martin Luther King and the beloved community. They're like reminders of something else. You enter into a different space, which in a way is a bit utopian, right? It's like, let's create the space that we all want to be in. And for those hour and a half on Sunday morning, maybe it actually feels like that. And what I wonder about then is the role of the digital world in that traditional church space. Because it strikes me there's a big competition now, in a sense, between the old brick and mortar church and where people typically hang out, which is in front of their computer screens.
Yeah. So actually, this brings me back to your question. Isn't church also technology? The way these buildings are constructed, the way we sit there in silence, is aided by the structure of the building.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. So, but you could use these stones to build a shopping mall.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the same holds true for these devices.
Yeah.
You could, of course, use them for, unlimited consumption or for mindfulness, not in the sense that the app does hours of mindfulness per day, please. Yeah. But you know, so I think I want to, on the one hand, embrace this technology in its potential. On the other hand, question if we've really used the potential of this technology, because what I can see with church is happening. So when I got invited to talk about sort of digital networks for churches, and I said, well, how can we use this to advertise our Sunday service?
Mm-hmm.
So you end up with just using that as it was designed by the creator, i.e. Steve Jobs. He wasn't. Engineers there were doing that. Mm-hmm. But I said, what about the subversive use of these technologies that has nothing to do with advertising a product, i.e. your Sunday service?
Mm-hmm.
And so I can see that we need to find these spaces that you've mentioned within the digital
world. So as a social worker, I'm, I guess, most concerned about the fact that we're bringing the technology in, it's going to show that it's really going to, you're not even going to notice that you're using it, but I feel like it's bringing, also in some ways, bringing people apart, because they communicate just through the phone, and so they don't know how to read people's emotions like they used to. So you go to a restaurant, you say three people at a table, instead of talking to each other, they're all, you know, on their phones doing, you know, things where they're not in the present, they're, you know, someplace else, you know, reading about something else. So that's what I'm most concerned about, that, you know, it does, you can communicate with people around the world, so in that way it brings people together, but I feel like it's bringing the emotional intelligence is going to go down of people, because they
They don't know how to read body language.
And there's actually a lot of discussion about this in the Chronicle. I read it. I taught freshmen last year, which was sort of an out-of-body experience.
And out of their body or out of the
world? Yes. The course was called Exploring Catholicism. They called it Exploring Mark Massa. You know, but my experience, and finally in the second class, they said, no social media at all.
Yeah.
You may not, your iPhone cannot appear in this classroom.
Yeah.
Because they were so busy.
Yeah.
Their interaction is, I know that some of them were chatting with their friends. Some of them were looking things up. Like I'd use the word, you know, eschatology, which they didn't understand. They type in the word and look it up. But in fact, they're interacting in their own world, and not with me, and certainly not with the rest of the class. So I think you're right. I think, and I mentioned this, and the phrase you just used is exactly the phrase that my colleagues in the emotional intelligence of college freshmen has dropped noticeably in a generation. Now, they're smarter in all kinds of other ways.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But and that's, I would say, directly the result of digital media. Uh-huh. Directly the result of digital media, which is an anti-communitarian thing. It's not. It doesn't help community. It's very much a crisis for community. So I agree with you.
Yeah. And that's really apparent to you that the EQ is down.
They can't read your body language because they're so used to getting information. Right. Siri, you know, I go with the Jesuit, who always likes to pick. He toys with Siri, why is there evil in the world, you know? That's a good question. I found thought, you know, so like, you know. But I mean, they're so used to getting their information about things like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they can't read you anymore.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I totally agree. But at the same time, I think, first of all, maybe what you're seeing is a very simple form of digital technology that is not capable of encompassing the fullness of what we as human beings are capable of. So maybe the question is rather, should we not ban this, or should we enhance it? Should we find a more meaningful way to engage with technology that would encompass the fullness of what we are capable of doing as humans? And this is where I see sort of my role. If I talk about utopias, the fullness of life, after all, and so I would be very critical of devices, of services that limit this. And so I would say there's a subversive potential if we could be part of the digital revolution and develop something that would foster human interaction, not just by digital detox, but actually by devices that do not get in the way of living in the here and now. But that's maybe something I have to do in the very distant future. Maybe I should become an app developer.
Well, one of the things that strikes me is that you have generations, and so the digital age within certain generations is much different, the relationship that they have. You have an older generation who, for whatever reason, some may embrace this new iPhone thing, or you can have my parents who just don't get it, and so they can't be a part of it. They're not part of whatever you're trying to kind of bring. When you have the generation that's now with, they do so much, and that's all their interaction, for the most part, is in the digital age. They use their phones constantly for just about anything. I mean, they don't even have to think anymore. They just press a button, Siri, how do I get to the blah, blah, blah? They don't think about, well, what road would be the best way to go? Like, you know, what am I going to see along the way? They just, they ask, they get the answer, and they do it, and they go. Whereas the older generations, or those that are not, I don't want to say older generation people, are not into technology, because there may be the middle of us, that it's a choice that they may or may not want to participate in it. So how do you reach those that don't want to be in the digital age?
Well, I think we had this similar question with people who haven't gotten the means of accessing digital technology, and I think that's something to be taken very seriously, and I hope to to have a conversation with where we'd explore that topic a bit further. But I think that again, the question is not so much do you want to use a particular device, but what is your vision for a better society? And if you can get there on a different route that does not mean you have to buy an iPhone, then that's what I would say is utopia not on the small screen again, not on the small screen anymore, but it still is utopia. But if we have to facilitate an exchange between those who use this and whose lives are shaped and influenced by this, and people who are critical, because that critical potential is I think will lead to developments in the digital. So I wouldn't just say these are the Luddites. Well, I'd say this is an important voice that needs to be heard in the digital realm. Those that either voluntarily opt out or those that cannot and do not want to access.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Christian.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.